This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
This is a Boardwalk Audio podcast.
Jeff Bezos is my daddy, and the best way to support my daddy is by going to boardwalkaudio.com/oncomedywriting and click the support our artist button, shop on Amazon like you normally would, and I get a little kickback. Please feed the daddy. This week's episode of On Comedy Writing is brought to you by Malia Obama.
On Comedy Writing. On Comedy Writing.
Thanks for downloading this episode of On Comedy Writing, the podcast about the business and craft of writing comedy. I'm your host, Alan Johnson. Before I introduce the guest, I want to talk about Dean Achard. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Lexa Graham started the satirical scientific journal, and she's looking for some more submissions. Go for it. It's a good way to get published, and once you get published once, you can keep rolling. It's a good way to get some momentum going. I browsed the site today, and I really like the article, PhD student celebrates paying thousands of dollars to write a paper only 17 people will read, because yeah, that's kind of how that stuff works. So it's good if you have like a good science background. Even then, you know, I think a lot of that stuff is universal. I'm horrible at science, but I can get a lot of the stuff. So check it out, make sure to read it, and submit. I think it's a great way to get your stuff out there. So our guest this week is Jason Kim. He's a very accomplished playwright. He's had multiple works go up around the city. And he's now transitioned to TV, where he's written for Girls, Love, and the most recent season of Barry. Very cool guy. Good episode. I should have more playwrights. Maybe I'll do that in the future. So here is Jason Kim. Jason, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Where are you from originally?
This is going great. I was born and raised in Seoul, in South Korea. And then I moved to St. Louis when I was 10, which was a fun little departure. And then I've been in New York for like the last 15, 16 years. So I guess New York. I don't really know how to answer the question.
Yeah, it's weird. Because like 10 years is a long time.
It's a long time.
What was it like growing up in Korea?
It was pretty amazing, I have to say. I grew up in Olympic Village, which was the town that they created sort of for the 88 Olympics. And so there were all these like, you know, like cool exercise equipment everywhere, and I never used any of them. So it's pretty fun.
That's such like a specific thing.
Yeah.
That's like a TV show right there. Yeah. Like the Olympic Village city.
A dumb kid walking around trying to use a pull-up bar. Yeah.
So it was like where the athletes stayed.
Yeah, basically. Whoa. Yeah. So we lived there for a couple of years, and that was really fun because they just had stuff, you know, everywhere. And my mom swears that we went to like all the events in the Olympics, and I was like 3 years old and I don't remember a thing, so she could just be lying. But yeah. She always shows me like a photo of like the two of us very close up, and she's like, see, this is us at the Olympics. And I'm like, okay, great, mom.
I went to the Salt Lake City Olympics.
Oh, cool.
In 2002. I remember nothing. 'Cause I was old enough though. I was nine.
Yeah.
But I still remember zero from it. I don't know.
I went there, I think, the year after, and they had opened the facilities for the greater public, and you could, like, take the luge down with the professional.
Whoa.
It was really cool. I did it when I was, like, when I was still a teenager, and it was, you know, it was deathly terrifying, but it was pretty cool. That's all I remember about Park City.
When did you first become interested, like, in writing?
That's a great question. I think I was always sort of a closeted writer. You know, have a lot of feelings, etc. But I didn't really start writing till I was in my early 20s. When I started, it all sort of poured out. But my background is in theater and in drama, really. And so I still, and especially back then, wrote like very sad, strange plays that nobody ever read or watched. So that's how I started.
Did you go to college for theater?
I went to graduate school for theater, okay. But in college I studied English.
Okay.
And I wanted to be very much, you know, like the good immigrant son. So I thought I should either go to law school or medical school or business school. And those were sort of the options. Or be a professor. Mm-hmm. But only at, you know, like a great school where my mother would be proud. And so those were sort of the options that were ahead of me. And then I didn't take any of them. Much to the dismay of my parents.
I'm my mom's Indian.
Oh, cool.
So I'm first generation, and she's also very disappointed in me.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So what made you decide to actually start writing?
So I was working at the New Yorker when I was right out of college, which was like a dream job for an English major. But I think I sort of knew from day one that it wasn't a good fit for me. And I did maybe the dumbest thing in the universe at the time. This was during the recession in like 2008, 2009. I quit my job when bankers were in their suits begging for money on the street. I just quit my job because I was an insane person. And then I took a government scholarship, unemployment, and I sat around for 3-4 months.
Is that called the government scholarship?
To me,
I didn't know that. I like that.
Just to me. And then I wrote everything I could for the subsequent 4 months. Mm-hmm. And what ended up coming out was a play. And then it all sort of snowballed from there.
Mm-hmm. What was the play about?
Oh, I couldn't even tell you. Yeah. I think it was, I honestly don't remember. But I can guarantee that it was very, very bad. And that I hope nobody ever sees it for as long as I live.
How long do you think it took you to get to like a play that you really enjoyed?
I would say probably, well, I'm still getting there, I think.
Yeah. That's interesting. A lot of people say that.
I had a great teacher named Laura Maria Sensabella in school, and I turned to her after turning in my, like, you know, 15th draft of a play, and I asked her, Laura, do you think this is done? And she looked at me and she smiled and she said, oh honey, a play is never done. And she's right, and I feel that way about scripts too.
Yeah that's interesting, because plays, like, I mean, you know, like Edward Albee added to what's that one called, the very famous play.
Who's afraid of Virginia Woolf?
No. Is it Edward? Am I even getting that right? It's the one with the park bench.
Oh, Zoo Story.
Zoo Story. Famously, he added that, like, the first half to it, you know?
Oh, yes, that's right. That's right.
And so it's kind of like the ultimate, like, the play is never done.
Yes.
And probably, I remember I read it and I was like, Stephen King? There's like a Stephen King reference. Like, wasn't this written like in the, like, way before Stephen King was alive? Or not live, but working?
What if he revised the play so he could put in the Stephen King line?
That's all you wanted,
like,
to do.
I really need to add in the Stephen King
line.
I'm
a big fan of him. Yeah. I'm going to pay homage to him in this. But that's interesting because, like, so that, like, you can add to and then you do a revival of it. And that's like a new thing. But like in script TV specifically,
yeah,
it's like you do this episode and it's like, that's it. That's,
yeah,
the episode.
That's it. It's over.
How do you like deal with that when you think of something's never done?
Oh, I guess you get a lot of alts. I don't, you know, that's a great question. I'm not sure. I always feel like everything's in progress, and the people who say like, oh, this is my complete finished polished product, or, you know, probably only like Martin Scorsese or somebody who actually can, but yeah, I always feel like everything's in progress all the time. And you just somehow like reach a breaking point and you're like, okay, great. We got to turn the cameras on. Let's hope for the best.
When you like started writing, what made you like stick with it when you were like, oh, this isn't as good as I'd like it to be. And this sucks.
Oh, chemical depression. The need for approval. desire for purpose. Why did I stick with it? I think I got very lucky early on in my career because when I was in graduate school, I worked for a couple named Dan Farteman and Anya Epstein on a television show called In Treatment, which was a fantastic experience. And as I was graduating, they brought me on to work on Grace Point. And so I got super, super lucky in that I really hit it off with them. I still see them regularly all the time. And they're really like the older brother and sister that I've always wanted, and who happen to be married. and so I sort of started doing it as a job, thinking that, you know, I could maybe get a TV job here and there and then do theater pretty much full time. But it didn't really work out that way. It worked out sort of the opposite way. Mm. And I've been very, very lucky, actually. So really by the good graces of people like Danny and Anya, have I, you know, mm-hmm. been able to write anything, really.
Mm-hmm. In treatment, they did like a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday schedule, right?
Yeah, that's right.
That's absurd.
Yeah, it was absurd. I think we shot the entire series. I think we had like 38 episodes that season or something. I think we shot the whole thing in like 2 or 3 months.
Wow.
Which is nuts.
Yeah.
I think we were on like a two days per episode, or maybe sometimes 3 days per episode.
Wow.
Isn't that insane?
And it's like, they're like half hours, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's ludicrous to even think that.
I guess it's one location, right? So that's.
Yes. Yeah. It's I would say 99% of it is one location.
Yeah.
There was a day where we had some, you know, some externals, and we were like, oh my God, we get to go outside today.
People forget that, though. That should be talked about as like an insane thing that happened on TV.
Oh, yeah. It was so insane. It was sort of right before the time where people were sort of, you know, blogging about TV shows and really talking about it on the internet. So maybe that's why. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I loved it. I thought, especially for Playwright, you know, those episodes are beautiful half hour one acts, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was such a nice introduction to TV for me.
Yeah.
And yeah, I still think about that show. I can't believe that they shot so many episodes.
That's absurd, yeah. If any AV Club freelancers listening right now, you got a good article here. What made you decide to do the MFA?
Well, I hadn't really written before. And I'm sort of a school junkie. I think if I could remain in school forever, I would. You know, how are you supposed to know if you're a human if you don't get a grade? And so I applied to a couple of schools in New York, and I just went to the one that gave me the most money. I ended up doing it really because I think of grad school as an investment in your own time. So I had never written before, so I needed to invest in time, in myself, really, to be able to have the space to be able to write. So that's really the reason why I went. I just wanted to walk away with a portfolio.
Mm-hmm. I'm in grad school currently at
Congrats.
NYU.
Congrats. How's it going?
It's good. I'm like finishing. This is it.
Oh, this is it.
I finished like in 2 weeks, I think.
Wow, and now you're a fully formed human.
I guess, yeah, I guess so.
When they give you the diploma, that's it.
It turns.
It turns. You start seeing color.
But we're pass-fail. Isn't that weird?
Oh, you are. That's actually great. I would have preferred that, actually.
I can see why, but also it feels a little bit, I don't know. The classes where we don't have like writing stuff to do, I do kind of like fuck off a little bit because it's like I can get the pass and move on, which is bad, which is not good. But the writing stuff I care about enough so that it doesn't matter, but the other stuff. Yeah,
I getcha.
I don't know.
So what are you studying there?
I'm doing dramatic writing.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. So does that mean screenwriting in addition to theater?
It's screenwriting, playwriting, and TV writing.
Oh,
it's all
three. Great. Good
so it's
for
been
you.
Fun. Yeah.
That's awesome.
I just had my thesis reading last week.
Oh, congratulations.
So, yeah.
How did it go?
It went okay. We had a, I guess I should, maybe I shouldn't publicly talk about this. One of the actresses, I think, didn't quite get the role.
Oh, yeah. Well, welcome to the world.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's interesting because you probably do a lot of readings.
I do.
So how do you prepare for a reading?
Oh, you take an Ambien. How do I prepare for a reading? Readings are such interesting business because they give you like 2 hours or like 5 hours if you're lucky to rehearse something and then put it up. And most of the people, you hope that they read it the night before. But, you know, a lot of people just come to a reading completely fresh-eyed, you know, and you got to make something work. And so I feel like readings are mostly about just hearing your words echoed back to you so that you could figure out what's not working.
Mm.
And it's I hope you didn't feel this way, but every time I have a reading, I'm like mortified. You know, even if like Meryl Streep is at the helm, I'm like, oh my God, I really fucked this up. I'm such a bad writer. Nothing is working. And in a sense, how could it be working? You know, you have no prep time and all the complexities in your writing that you want to communicate. How can you do that within 2 hours? So yeah, readings are a funny business.
Yeah. How much do you change stuff because of a reading?
Oh, it depends, I think. But I end up changing a lot once I'm in rehearsal. Especially because I can and because I want to tailor the language to the actors. And I think that's true both in theater and on screen. Because, you know, if Anthony Carrigan has a line that can be said in his voice that's funnier, that's, you know, better suited for him, then of course he should do it that way. Mm-hmm. And we'll figure out a way to do that. So yeah, I ended up changing a lot in rehearsal.
That's interesting because obviously like in TV or in movies, that makes a lot of sense because you do, you know, this one time and it's gone. But it's funny to think like you change a line for this one thing, and then like when you like have the script that you like let people do, it's like as that line, it's like, oh, well, this only works when it's this guy doing it.
Yeah. It's a tricky balance. Yeah. And then to give everybody the freedom to, you know, play around, make sure that everybody's comfortable. That's the thing that you don't get taught in grad school that you have to teach yourself once you graduate. You know, you're like, oh, I have to be now the CEO of my own creative enterprise. Like what is that about?
Yeah.
And make sure everybody's happy and getting enough pizza and also artistically fulfilled. Like what?
Yeah, it's a weird thing you don't think about. That's a tricky thing.
Yeah. I feel like every MFA should come with an MBA.
Because I think they do that at some places.
Oh, they do?
I don't know. Maybe not.
Wow. I mean, I was a hot idea. I guess already somebody took it. Congrats.
Once you're like at it, well, how do you go about getting your stuff produced? That seems so difficult.
Oh, well, I beg and plead and threaten and bribe. You mean in theater or in TV?
In theater, yeah.
In theater, I think most of development in theater, I think requires you to do at least one reading, sometimes several readings. And I think every theater, especially New York, sort of has its own programming needs depending on the season. Hopefully that artistic director or the lit manager, has had eyes on your play and thinks that it could be a great fit for the season. I know this sounds all sort of pedantic, but I think a lot of it is sort of how to make the Rubik's Cube work in that particular season. Mm-hmm. And I think that happens so differently every year for every writer.
Right.
Like my friend, I just heard, has been workshopping a play for 6 years and it's finally going up next season. And I will bet you money that it was probably really ready to go like 5 years ago. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, for instance, with my musical that I did called K-Pop, that was, I think, 5 or 6 years in the making as well. And we eventually just had to beg and plead enough people to give us money to do something insane with a cast of 18. And somehow it just happened in that moment where like everybody was available and it was just happening. So it's always unforeseen and you always kind of have to be ready, I think.
Right. What was the story behind K-pop? How'd that get started?
So we workshopped that play for that musical for a long time with three different theater companies that were involved with Ars Nova, the Woodshed Collective, Teddy Bergman, who conceived it with me and who directed the production, and Mayi, which is this fantastic Asian American company based in New York. And I would say we all wanted to do a musical about the Korean music industry for probably like the first year. And then we sat around being like, what is this? How do we make a musical about that? And then it started to sort of take shape, I would say, like in year two or three. And then eventually it became this strange and wild immersive experience where you sort of follow three different storylines that all converge into a big, gigantic K-pop concert at the end. Mm-hmm. And we didn't really figure that out until really we were kind of in rehearsal. So it was, I would say it was an active, it was an active development until the moment that until opening night.
Yeah.
And I hope to work on it more, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I do. Just because once you put a thing on its feet, you see so much, you know, and you can spend all day writing in your head with your laptop and you think you know it all. And then you put it in the hands of an actor, or director, or lighting designer, sound designer, and you're like, oh, I didn't know anything. And so I would say I learn more by watching the first runs of things than really I ever do just sitting with the laptop.
It's interesting. When you're developing something for that long, and I'm sure that can get kind of frustrating. How do you have like some sort of like, I don't know, what do you do during that time to like get like good creative energy going?
Oh God. The replenishment is important, I think. You have to always reinvest and replenish. And it's something that I was very bad at for the first 5-6 years. And then I'm starting to get a little better. I think burnout is real, and every person has to figure out a way to revive themselves. And for me, it's not writing, which is very hard, actually, because I immediately start to think of myself as a failure if I'm not writing. I'm like, oh, you didn't write today. You're an idiot. You know, that's the voice that comes blaring on in my head. And so what I've learned to do is instead say, okay, you're not going to write today, or you're not going to write this week or this month even, because you have nothing to give. And I have to be aware of that, I think. Someone once told me that the most important relationship you have as a writer is between yourself and your writing. And as corny as that sounds, I think it's kind of true. And sometimes I'm like, oh, I need to take time off, and I need to just watch Drag Race for the 50th time, or I need to go walk around in a museum to feel inspired, or I need to just eat every single chocolate I can get my hands on. Yeah. And it just depends on what your needs are, I think.
That's interesting, because I'm in between where I think like, well, if writing is a job, you know, you should go 9 to 5, yeah, you should write. But also, it is like creatively, like it's hard to do that. Yeah. It's hard to be.
I can't do it.
Me neither. But I think I'm not sure yet if that's just because I'm a lazy guy or if that's the way the process has to be.
I doubt it. I can really only have 3 good hours in a day.
Mm.
I mean, I have written for like 15 hours at a time, of course, but it's not good. No one would read that the day after and be like, "Oh, you really nailed it." I really think you kind of tap out at a certain point.
Yeah. How do you go about writing a musical?
Oh, you have many, many, many conversations with your musicians, with your composer and lyricist, and you try to really figure out how to create the architecture so that the story will exist as scaffolding for the music. And at least that's how I view it anyway. Mm-hmm. Because no one goes to a musical to just watch, you know, scenes over and over and over again. You want to hear the music. And hopefully if you guys do your job right, then everything feels fully integrated, mm-hmm, and of one sound mind. But it is a very intense collaboration, I have to say. Mm-hmm. And I really had a great time because I love the composers that I worked with. And I played music growing up. And so I was like, oh, this is really fun for me. I get to sort of flex those muscles again. But it's really hard. And that's why it takes a long time, actually. Because you not only have your own brain to contend with, you have the brains of many, many people.
it's interesting because like writing in general is very like isolating and very lonely. Playwriting, I imagine, more so than TV writing because you're not in a room and stuff. But the musical, that seems like it's very much like you're all in it together as a team.
Yeah. I would say even that feels lonely sometimes.
Yeah.
But in general, I feel lonely all the time. But that's probably a different problem. I think there are times also in a musical where you just have to shut yourself out and say, shut yourself up and say, okay, I'm going to sit here and figure out what this scene is. And I think that's true also of TV, actually. When you are on set and you and the scene needs a rewrite, you know, you could write by committee, of course, but really, it most of the time requires the mind of one writer who can go and really isolate what's not working and what is working and figure it out. And of course, you have a team behind you to help you and to take over if you need. But yeah, I view writing as very solitary, which my therapist probably thinks is a big problem. But that's how I think about it.
No, I mean, it is implicitly.
Yeah.
Is there a certain like a structure difference in writing a musical than a play? I know very little about musicals. I saw Oklahoma, which was great.
Oh, yeah. It was great, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah,
I loved it.
It was really good. It was really modern.
Yeah.
Without changing like, a word,
yeah.
Which is interesting.
I really need to read that book, actually, because I'd never seen Oklahoma before.
Me neither.
And I was... Oh, you hadn't either.
No. But, but I was with people who had, and I was like, is this like different at all? And they're like... By the like the word, the language, and the music was kind of like more modernized, I guess.
Yeah.
But like it's like not at all different, apparently.
Wow, that's really shocking to me.
Yeah,
and phenomenal actually, because the book seemed so dark.
Yes,
so dark.
And see with Judd in the
Oh my god! At the end of it, I was like, I wondered if they wrote it this way or if they got permission to revise or what, because and how people viewed it when it came out. At first.
Right.
Because my understanding of Oklahoma is, you know, like Hugh Jackman in a cowboy outfit, like traipsing around the stage, you know, what they did was entirely different. And it made me wonder like, oh, I guess so much is really up to the interpretation because those are two different experiences, really.
Yeah. What do you think that ending meant? I wasn't sure. I guess spoilers for Oklahoma. If you're in New York City, don't fast forward to this part.
I sort of thought of it as an indictment on current America.
Interesting. Okay.
And the way that even the good guys can manipulate justice. And especially when you're sort of in a contained environment that you can really do whatever you want. I think. But
I like that. It's interesting. It's funny because I actually just saw To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh yeah, how was that?
It was great. It was actually I thought I would not like it because Aaron Sorkin can be kind of whatever. But there's very few of the Sorkinisms that I find annoying in it. He leads off from the top with one. I won't spoil it.
Okay.
It is very annoying. But there's a really few of not as many as you think of that. But the ending. I don't know if you're familiar with the book. Like
I am.
Because like that's the ending with like Boo Radley.
They
cover for him. I guess
right.
So it's kind of a similar thing, but that's more of a maybe a positive. Actually, I don't know now I talk about it. I don't know. But they're kind of similar endings, I guess.
Sorkin's got ya.
Sorkin got me, yeah. He did it again.
He got to ya.
But anyway, instead of talking specifically with these two very things, but structurally, is there a difference in musicals versus plays?
Oh, absolutely. I think that plays are really driven by language, and I think in musicals... you drive through music. And so I think you have to put music first to a certain extent as you're writing and allow it to hopefully dictate what you're writing and how you're writing around it.
Mm.
And I find that depending on the kind of musical you're doing, you know, you need to give the songs a jumping board. You know, is that what it's called when people dive? Oh, no, a diving
board.
Wow, sports. Wow, really hard for me. What is a jumping board?
That's not even a thing. The Olympic Village.
I know. What a failure. Because I think you need to create a reason for characters to sing. And so a lot of the times it's about creating an emotional situation that will allow people to break out into song.
Mm. That makes sense.
Whereas in a play, you do whatever you want, really.
Right. Yeah. Do you find... What's like your approach to writing a play?
Oh, I sit and call my mom, and then I cry a lot. I'm like, Mom, tell me about all the horrible things I did when I was a child. And she's like, okay, you ready? And then I cry. The process of writing a play, for me, always begins with a question. If there's something on my mind that I cannot work out, that I feel particularly terrified about, then I avoid it at first, for as much as possible, and then I return to it somehow. And I pick at it over and over and over again until I have a realization, oh, this should be a play. And I think for me as an audience, the best kind of plays wrestle with a question and usually with a huge question that to a certain extent is not answerable. And so that's the way that I view playwriting. If I have a question that's big enough to not be answered, then I should probably tackle it the form of a play.
Yeah. I know. So K-pop, you mentioned that it had a huge cast.
Yes.
Which is like unheard of in American theater.
Yes.
Was that like difficult to get?
It was, but I have to say the three theaters that were involved were so wonderful and supportive of that vision, because the thing about Korean pop music is they have bands that are huge.
Right.
You know, like you look at Girls' Generation, you're like, oh my God, they added another person. Where did that person come from? And then they have, you know, like the Korean version of the band, and then there's different versions depending on what country you're in. I mean, it's nutty. And so I always felt like the scale was important in communicating what the music actually was. And once I explained that to the producers, they were like, okay, great. Let's try to find, you know, 18 Korean people who can sing and dance and who look hot. And I was like, best of luck. But I think once they understood that there was an artistic impulse behind it, they were really supportive.
Mm-hmm. And how hard was it to cast?
It was really, really difficult.
I can imagine, yeah.
It was very difficult. Because there is a lack of visibility for Asian Americans, both, I think, in front of the screen on stage and behind the scenes. And so I wonder, and this is just a guess, if a lot of Asian American kids grow up not even knowing that they could be an actor or they could be on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And I think the tides are changing, hopefully.
You're wearing the Sandra Oh shirt.
I am. I came to represent.
Yeah.
I just got it today. I felt like I should wear it. But it's funny to me also, speaking of Sandra Oh, because she has been around for a while, and she has been doing phenomenal work for a long time. And so for her to finally be recognized feels both incredible and a little like, really? Like, now you guys are up on Sandra Oh? You've been sleeping on Sandra Oh for the last 25 years, and now you're really? She's been amazing since day one, you know? But I'm really happy about it. It's so great. I think it's really hard for Asian performers because they lack models, I think.
Mm-hmm. But but it's, you know, I guess like there's Crazy Rich Asians. I mean, things are going in a good direction.
Yes, yes. I will be happy when there are 10 Crazy Rich Asians every season.
Right.
I remember when they were doing Hamilton, you know, it was such a phenomenon on every level. And people were kind of walking around like, oh, we really cracked the code. Like, now Broadway's fully diverse. And I was like, that is not true.
Right.
And wouldn't it be amazing if we had three Hamiltons in a season? Yeah. I mean, wouldn't that be phenomenal? Then you could actually get a ticket.
Right.
Maybe. I think I'll be happy when there are 10 Crazy Rich Asians, when there are 10 Fresh Off the Boats. And I think the reason why some creators and some viewers have a hard time is because there isn't a plurality. You know, it's like going to the deli every day and you only get one thing. Mm. I really want there to be more and more and more and more. And I mean, this is the irony, I think, of quote unquote, you know, people of color content. It's proven over and over again to be not only artistically rewarding, but financially successful, and yet people still hesitate. Mm-hmm. And so I really hope that people can look at these models and know that and rest assured that, oh, we can really start expanding the horizon a little bit and we'll be fine.
Yeah, expanding the playwright's horizon.
That's right. That's right.
Why do you think so many playwrights are having so much success in TV right now?
I think because playwrights are taught story, and oftentimes when you're in a room, what you're there for is to provide story. Mm-hmm. And I think we're sort of in a lucky moment in television where a lot or most content is character driven, and playwrights are obsessed with character. You know, like I sit at home and I write character bios like a sad person.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I do. I really enjoy it.
Do you do that for like the TV shows you work for too?
Sometimes, yeah, totally. Yeah. I make a list of like 100 things that have happened in their lives.
Wow.
And I like doing it because I'm a huge nerd. and I like wasting time. And so I think because playwrights sort of think from that headspace, they have become helpful.
Mm-hmm. You've done a lot of TV. It's like most of what you've been doing lately.
Mm-hmm.
Do you plan on like going back to theater?
I do. I try to go back to theater as much as possible. Mm-hmm. I would say theater, when I'm writing a play, feels very restorative. And then once it's up, I wanna die because there are so many things that have to change. But once you're at home writing a play at your little desk, it's heaven. You mm-hmm. know, you get to do whatever you want.
Right, because TV, there's like way more rules to the stuff.
Yeah, and I really enjoy all the rules. Actually, I really as a type A immigrant, I really enjoy the boundaries that TV provides. But yeah, sometimes you just need to let loose, I think.
Yeah. What would be your advice to someone trying to start a career in playwriting right now?
Don't. No, I'm just kidding. Please do. I would say one thing that's been very hard for me to learn, which I am still learning, is that to a large extent, you have to dwell in uncertainty as a writer. And I think that applies not only artistically, but also in your career, in a business sense, because things can come together, fall apart. And a lot of the times it's out of your control. And I think that can drive a person crazy.
Yeah.
And I totally understand why. It's like when you're young, you're just waiting for that phone call that's going to change your life, you know? Or you're just waiting to meet that agent who's going to just open doors for you. Or you're going to finally meet an executive who can put your show on the air or whatever it is. And you know what? A lot of the times, even after you have those meetings, things remain uncertain. And even when you're shooting shows, they're uncertain. And I think you have to learn how to live with it and not spin out. I think that's what I would tell my younger self. Like, relax. It's going to be fine. It's out of your control.
I was thinking about this recently. Like, unless you're like, I don't know, like Lauren Michaels or somebody, every script is like a job, and then it ends, and then you have to have another job, you know?
Yeah.
It's like you write on a show, it ends, I need another show. Or write a movie.
Oh, yeah.
Or a play. It's just like, so that sucks.
Yeah. Every time I finish something, I'm like, oh, I have nothing left.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, oh, I don't have another play. I don't have another scene. I don't have another line. Like, I have nothing. Mm-hmm. Which is why I think it's important to replenish. But I feel that way a lot. And you also never know when someone's going to hit the reset button for you on your behalf. Somebody might come and be like, okay, this is over. You're like, oh, okay, cool. Thank you so much. Thank you. So, yeah, I think that's just the nature of the business, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's. I feel people don't understand that. Like, outsiders don't understand that. In terms of, like, I feel like bad for, like, actors who have to, like, go to a job interview, like, 3 times a day.
Yeah, it's insane. I don't know how people audition. Yeah. I don't understand it. As somebody who's been on the other side of it, I don't get it. I'm like, this is such a vulnerable experience. I feel so bad.
Yeah, I don't know. Good on them.
Yeah, good on them.
One of your first TV jobs was on Girls.
Yeah, it was.
How did that come about?
That came about because Lena and Jenny read a sad play of mine And I guess they liked it enough to have a conversation with me. And then I got hired for season 4, and I ended up working on that show for the rest of its duration. And it was a phenomenal experience. Mm-hmm. I still miss that show all the time, every day. And it was one of, you know, my first jobs, and it really, in many ways, defines how I think about storytelling and mm-hmm. comedy. And yeah, it was a thrilling time.
What do you think, what about it, the play do you think drew them to you?
I don't know. You'd have to ask them. Yeah. I have no idea. It'd be really funny if they were like, oh, we thought you were David Henry Hwang. Sorry. wrong person.
That would have been crazy if they hired him.
That would have been really funny. Yeah, that would have been really, I mean, they would have been lucky. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Had you been looking to get into television?
Well, so I was already working on Grace Point at the time.
Oh, right, right.
But I was thinking at the time that, oh, once this is over, then, you know, I'll go back to working freelance or work at a startup or wait tables or whatever it takes. So, it was actually a surprise, I think, on every level when I ended up jumping to that show immediately after.
Mm-hmm. And are there any skills you think that are specific to, like, theater that you brought to, like, the writer's room and for TV?
Oh, well, I don't think I have any skills, especially marketable real-life ones. You know, I'm not sure. The great thing about girls, for me, was that people were really open and allowed to be vulnerable mm-hmm. and encouraged to be so. And I really enjoy that, actually, because my favorite hobby is crying, as you've already probably figured out. And I've been to a lot of therapy. And so having an environment that supported that was great. Mm-hmm. And so I could go in there and say, oh my God, this is what my ex just did to me on the internet. You know, oh my God, this is what my parents just said to me on the phone. Like, oh my God, here's a great memory that I had when I was first living in New York. And you could just share. Mm-hmm. And then let it bubble into something that could go on screen. Mm-hmm. So that was really great.
Yeah.
And I want every room to be that way, because then I think you get something really personal and something truthful, hopefully.
Have you read The Antipodes? Is that how you say it?
I think so, but I haven't read it. I was in LA during that time. Mm-hmm. I was bummed out that I missed that production. I heard it was fantastic.
I didn't see it, and I've only read half of it. Don't have much to say, but it is that did remind me of it, because there are moments where they talk about...
it's your favorite play, right?
It's my favorite play, yeah. Oh, I love it. I do love Annie Baker, though. She's great.
Yeah, she's amazing.
But yeah, I guess, I don't know. You're like the one of the few guests I have on this show that I could probably ask about in The Antipodes.
I think, if I'm remembering correctly from a friend's description, it's set in a writer's room.
That's why,
and then it like evolves into, you know, larger questions about your existence and the world and meaning and et cetera, which sometimes you kind of get to in a writer's room when you're on like hour 10 or whatever, and everybody's overly caffeinated, and you've talked through every little detail that you possibly could. You're like, oh my God, what does this all mean?
Well, it's interesting because, like, the way they portray it is, like, the showrunner's, like, mining your stories. Like, but he's, like, not in the way that you say it, where it's, like, very, like, it's a very open room, but he's, like, I need these stories for the show. which I think is pretty fascinating and probably kind of true for some writer's rooms, I'd bet.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. Yeah.
Especially, it's like, I feel like a How I Met Your Mother type show. It was a lot of, like, so what's your dating stories, guys?
Yeah, of course. Of course. And you have to be, I think, cognizant of what you are willing to share and what you're not.
Yeah.
And it's okay if you don't share something, I think, always.
What's it like joining a show in the middle of its run?
For me, it was great because I already knew the characters. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, great. Like, I know what Shoshana is about. I know what Adam is like, you know? And so for me, it was like, oh my God, the hard part's over. They already did the hard work. Now I could sort of come in and try to help tinker with what they've done already.
And that must have been a fun show for you, because you're like a New York guy, and
I'm a New York dude.
You're a New York dude, and you're like around this. You're probably like around the same age as those characters, so it kind of probably felt comfortable to write that.
Yeah, it did feel really comfortable. I felt like I was writing my friends, which was cool.
Mm-hmm. What was working with Lena Dunham like?
She's amazing. Mm-hmm. I really owe her and Jenny and Judd so much. You know, I owe them everything. And I remember the first day of season four, we were shooting our first day on the soundstage, and she was directing an episode that she had written that she was also starring in. And, you know, she was still in her 20s at the time, I think. And I was like, what? It's like, I can't even get my shit together to get breakfast in time.
Right.
You know, how are you doing this? And so I really admire her so much mm-hmm. for how much she put into that show.
Yeah. It is absurd how good the show is, considering how young she was and how much responsibility she had for every role.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's incredible.
Yeah. When it was the last season, what was it like trying to, like, tie up all the loose ends and end the show?
It was sad, I think, for a lot of us to say goodbye. And I think it was Judd who said, let's not have a typical ending, which is what inspired the series finale, if I'm remembering correctly. And that really took the pressure off. To be like, okay, like, we don't need to do the kind of 6 feet under, here's how they all die version, which I love.
Spoiler alert.
Which I, sorry, guys.
For 6 feet under.
Sorry, guys. So sorry. Sorry, Mr. Ball. And so that really, I think, took the load off. Yeah. And we could then imagine what Hannah's life would be like, mm-hmm. like 6 months from then.
Yeah. How did working on Love come about?
Love came about because I had worked with Judd Apatow on Girls, and they needed another writer for the third season. Oh my God, what am I even saying? Lord. And so it came about that way. And I hadn't been in a room in LA before, and so that was my first LA experience, and it was so strange to me, because we wrote on the Paramount lot, and I was like, what do you mean you could just walk over to the set? I was like, what are you talking about? You know? In New York, everything sort of spread out. Like, you could have a room in Soho, and then you could be shooting in, like, the Bronx or something, you know? And I was like, oh, you just, like, walk down the street when you want lunch and go to the cafeteria, and then you, like, go back and you go to set. It was very confusing to me.
What's that like, going from New York to L.A.?
Oh, I really love L.A. for small chunks at a time, and then I have a hard time. But... you know, LA's great. How can you complain about LA? Yeah. It's you don't even have to ever look at your weather app. You know, that probably saves you like 45 minutes in a week. it's amazing, and it's really cool to be around other people who are doing the same thing. Because in New York you don't get that sense. You know, you're constantly confronted with everything that's not writing all the time. And in LA, which is very much a company town, I think you are surrounded by writers who sort of can understand and empathize with what you're going through. So if you're sitting at a bar having your 15th glass of wine, writing and crying, then no one's going to bother you, you know, which is kind of great.
Yeah. Is it difficult having New York as a home base when you're doing like TV jobs?
It can be. But, you know, I've been here for a long time at this point, and I really love New York. I identify as a New Yorker. And so, you know, it's like removing Carrie Bradshaw from New York or something. So I hope to stay here for as long as possible, for the rest of my life, really. Mm-hmm. And hopefully someday the industry can move here. Not all of it, but, you know, just a small chunk of it.
Do you think it's been more or less in the last couple of years?
In my experience, it's been less.
Yeah, that's what I think too.
Yeah, and it's a bummer. Mm-hmm. But, you know, all you cool LA people, move out here, please. And create shows and give us jobs. Mm-hmm. Which is a sad for me, actually, because New York is a great place to shoot.
Yeah, it's true. It's weird that like a lot of shows are set in New York and shoot in like the sound stages.
Yeah, or Toronto or wherever. Yeah. And you can always tell.
It's, right.
You know, like I used to walk around fake New York. I always walk around fake New York on whichever lot I'm on.
It's fun.
It's really fun. Yeah. It's a little creepy.
It is, because like, there's like fake walls and it's like, everything's hollow.
Exactly. It's a strange experience. But I'm like, oh, I really want to go down this train station that is going to lead to nowhere because I miss home. But you can always tell, I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Love is kind of like almost a West Coast Girls.
Yeah, yeah.
How did that job differ from Girls, though?
Love was really an amazing model because it really zooms in on the story. Mm-hmm. And so the conceit I found so fascinating, where you're really zooming into every nook and cranny of a relationship and getting to go a little slower if you want and tell the story that you want of one moment, you know? And I didn't think storytelling like that was really possible. I thought you could do it in a novel, mm-hmm. but maybe not on screen. And so it was a great learning experience for me. Because I was like, oh, right, if this happens yesterday in Gus's life, then when we pick up the next day in the next episode, then this has to happen. You know, it was sort of different. Like, you were sort of looking at the story through a microscope or something.
Because that whole series is like over like 8 months or something?
Yeah, or something like that. Yeah. Yeah.
That's wild. I didn't even think about that because I've seen that show like a lot. And
it's pretty crazy. Yeah.
I always find it so fascinating. Like, Paul Rust is like the funniest.
He's the best.
The funniest dude. And in that show, he's like not really playing to like the funniest like version of himself. He's like trying to play a more grounded thing, which is very interesting to me.
Yeah, the one wonderful thing about Paul is that I think he's such a good actor.
Yeah.
And he has like a torrent of thoughts and feelings inside him, and I'm so glad he got to express it. Mm-hmm. And that's how I feel about Bill Hader. You know, who knew he was such a phenomenal actor? Like, my God, that guy can really act.
You kind of knew from SNL.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you totally did. Yeah, you totally did. But I don't know. This feels a little different or something. Sure. Like, it feels like he's doing work that, you know, that should be in, like, a Russian stage in the 18th century or something. It's that good. Yeah, it's really... I'm so glad that these creators have the venue now to be able to express themselves fully.
Yeah. And how did... you worked on Barry. How did that come about?
Barry came about... I think that was... I was available at the time because I had just, something must have fallen apart. I don't remember, but I met with, Amy, who's one of the producers on the show, and they had sent me a link to the first season before it aired, and I watched the whole thing in one go. I think I started it at like 9 p.m. and then I finished at like 1 a.m. and I was like, holy fuck, what was that? That was amazing. Yeah. And then I had breakfast with Amy, who I will roast her for the rest of her life for this, who ordered a bagel and lox without the lox. And I was like, so just a bagel? which I find so funny at the time.
Was it really just a bagel?
Yeah, it was just, so they just brought a bagel without, they brought like a bagel and lox platter without the lox.
Oh,
and
so I had all this stuff.
I thought it was so funny. I thought it was so funny. And I was like, great, I adore you. You're my people. I will take the salad with everything on the side. You know, like it was hilarious to me. And so we had a great meeting. And then I met Bill and Alec after. And I feel bad because I forced Bill to take a walk in New York. He was like visiting New York for something at the time. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really put the two and two together that people would be screaming running up to him. And I was like, ooh, that was not a great place to meet. Sorry, guys. On the street. Yeah, probably not a great place to meet an actor. And we all hit it off. And so I joined for season two. And that was an amazing experience. I mean, one of the most formative experiences I've had.
As we're talking, I'm realizing that those three shows, Girls, Love, and Barry, were all creators who are starring in it.
Yeah.
How did that, like, change things?
Oh, it's always great to have the creator in a room. Mm-hmm. Because you know what's going to work or not. You know, like, you know what can fit Lena like a glove. Mm-hmm. And what notes she's really capable of playing on screen and what notes you really want her to play, you know? And so it's really, as the character, I mean, not as Lena, but right. As Hannah. And the same with Paul and the same with Bill. And they can tell you, like, oh, that's not going to really land. Mm-hmm. And here's a different way to make it land in my body, you know, with my face, which is amazing, actually. Yeah. Like, when do you get to do that? It makes the job so much easier, I think.
Mm-hmm. And all those shows are like, you know, they're very funny, but they're also heavily serialized. There's a lot of story.
Yeah.
And they're kind of dark.
Yeah, they're pretty dark.
Is that kind of your voice, would you say?
I think so. I mean, who knows what my voice is. But yeah, I like darker material.
Yeah.
I think probably because I used to write very sad plays.
And Barry specifically has like really absurdly funny moments.
Yeah.
Juxtaposed with like, you know, huge violence.
Yeah.
And like very sad things happen.
Yeah.
How do you balance that tone? I'm always amazed. I haven't seen all of season two yet, but I watched the first episode recently. It was a phenomenal season premiere.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
I take full credit. Bill, are you listening? I take full credit. No, that was all Bill and Alec. I think on Barry, the tone kind of reveals itself after we figured out the story. And that's what feels great about it. Like, we don't go in saying, oh my God, it's going to be 70% dark, 30% funny this season. And this episode has to be the opposite because it hasn't been funny, you know, enough or whatever. We're just, right. We're like, oh, this is a story we want to tell and let's make it funny. Mm-hmm. And we let, you know, we let the story sort of take control, which is, I think, the way to do it.
Right. And you started writing that the second season before the first season finished airing, right?
Yeah.
How did that, like, when the first season, like, finished airing, did that change things around?
Well, we got a second season pickup, which is great.
Right.
You know, it was really amazing, actually, because I think we started the second season when, like, episode 2 was airing or something like that, if I'm remembering correctly, and the response was so positive. And you know, you create something in a bubble, and then how do you know? You have right. No idea. Like, you could create also the best thing in the world and no one could give a shit,
right?
Which happens a lot, I think. And so to get the kind of response that we were getting, I think made everybody even more jazzed and confident. And also, you know, then there's the flip side where you get in your head and you're like, oh my God, what do we do with the second season? People are liking the first season. This is insane. But yeah, it was a great time.
Mm-hmm.
It's very exciting.
Was there ever like a worry when you went there, like, oh, what if this show just like sucks so hard that they cancel it? They cancel the second season before the first season ends.
Oh God, you always have that worry. And that's happened to so many people.
Yeah.
And to so many of my writer friends and to me. And it just, you know, it just, you gotta, that's when the reset button is hit for you on your behalf.
Yeah.
And you gotta figure it out.
And I know you're doing development right now of your own stuff. How's yeah. that been going?
It's been going great. Mm-hmm. So I'm working on a show right now called K-Town with Greta Lee, my long lost sister, for HBO. And that's been really phenomenal because I get to tell the story of our families. And, you know, writing with Greta has been such a joy. She is so funny. We just sit and laugh together. And I'm so glad that we're telling such a personal story, because for a long time we were kind of going around being like, oh, what if we do a show about a girl who really loves a boy? Like, oh, what if we do a show about, you know, a girl who has a superpower or something stupid? Those shows are not stupid.
Shots
by the way.
Fired at Supergirl.
Sorry. No, I mean, our version was stupid. And then we were like, oh my God, all we do when we get together is talk about ourselves as immigrants and our families. So what are we doing? Like, let's write about what we know. And so that was a big revelation for us. And that's been a real joy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's been really great. And then I'm working on a couple of other things too. And, you know, juggling.
Right.
Who knows?
What was the pitching process like?
Oh, the pitching process can be very intense, and it depends for every show. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for those of you who don't know what a pitch process looks like, you go in with a script, basically. That's a monologue or sometimes a dialogue. And you go in and you really read and communicate, using visuals if you want or whatever, what the TV show is, mm-hmm. or what the movie is. And it's a harrowing process.
It's weird that like most people want visuals, which I find very odd.
Yeah, I've never done the visual thing. I've never done it.
It's like you're doing like a PowerPoint, like, and this is a, yeah.
Yeah, but some people are so amazing at it. It's like you're watching a TED Talk.
Yeah.
I'm not a TED Talk person. Mm-hmm. You know, every time I go into a pitch, I'm like, oh, I'm going to shit my pants. And then I sit down and I'm like, okay, just read off the page. No visuals for you. Sorry. So, yeah, I don't know. It's really hard to communicate, I think, what you see in your head.
Yeah.
In a kind of formal way, you know, that's not on screen yet. Mm-hmm. And so the way that has been successful for me is I always come from some personal place. And so I inevitably end up talking about my grandmother or what I experienced as a child, or some crazy story from my past, mm-hmm. whatever I'm going through, yeah. just so that I could draw some connections.
And that makes sense for like a show like K-Town. That's yeah. kind of about that. But do you do that for other projects too?
I do. I always do. And yeah. even when I write, I have to figure out a way in. You know, even if I'm mm-hmm. adapting a story, I'm like, mm-hmm. oh, why do I want to do this?
Yeah.
The why question I try to ask as much as possible until I'm driven completely mad.
That's interesting. Because they do, like, when you're taught, like, how to pitch, I guess you're taught how to pitch. But when yeah. you're taught, they always say, like, you know, you got to say, like, why this is personal to you and stuff. And I always thought of that as, like, well, I think it's personal because I like to do it because it's funny or it's, like, interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
But I guess there's more to it. I mean, that makes sense.
Well, I think some shows people do because it's funny and interesting.
Yeah.
And I think that's really cool, actually. What works for me is a lot of tears. but that's just what works for me, mm-hmm. you know? I don't know if you could sort of say like philosophically, okay, like here's the best way to do it.
Yeah.
But yeah, you just got to communicate what you're saying in your head, mm-hmm. which sometimes they give you a pitch prompt. And of course there are like the things that you have to hit. Like, what does the pilot look like? Who are the characters? What's the tone?
Right.
But you know, as long as you're communicating in some effective way, I think you're good.
Yeah. I imagine you're fine tuning a pilot right now.
I am.
So what do you like want to get out of a pilot?
Oh God, funds to make more. What do I have to get out of a pilot? Pilots are so hard.
Yeah.
Why are they so hard? They're so impossible.
Well, because you're making like a whole world.
Yeah, it's so hard.
It's interesting that they hire off of pilots for stuff.
Yeah.
I feel like specs are much more indicative of like what a TV writer would bring.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. I never had to write a spec.
Yeah. I guess no one has to do it anymore.
Yeah. If you could write a spec, what spec would you write?
Well, I wrote a Brooklyn Nine-Nine spec.
That's awesome.
Which is a good show. I like it.
Yeah.
I don't know, though. Yeah. But Brooklyn Nine-Nine, it's a good show.
Yeah. I don't know what I would write. I would probably be dumb and like write a spec for a show that's off the air or something.
Yeah.
And then really no one would hire me ever. Yeah, it is weird that people hire off pilots. Mm-hmm. It's weird that this industry exists.
Well, that's
period,
true too,
really,
yeah.
In the way that it does. Yeah, I don't really know what I hope to get out of a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
I think the pilots that have been successful for me as a viewer are the ones where you also sort of know that the show is going to wrestle with something. Even if it's a comedy, you know, there has to be a there. And I think you could tell most of the time.
Yeah, interesting. What kind of pilots do you like, or what type?
Oh, man. Well, I really love the Six Feet Under pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Love the Sopranos pilot. Have you seen, you know what I recently rewatched was a Sex and the City pilot.
Oh, really?
It is so different than the rest of the show.
Mm-hmm.
There's like direct address.
And oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. I forgot that they did that. But it's actually very pretty effective.
Mm-hmm.
So, oh, God, I don't know. Pilots that I enjoy. I love the Barry pilot. Pilots that I've seen recently that I've loved. I'm not sure.
Have you seen Ozark?
No, I haven't seen Ozark. I heard it's so good.
It's a good show. And the pilot, I think, is pretty effective at that.
Yeah. Yeah, so why do you think it's effective?
Well, it's very tense.
Uh-huh.
And I think it kind of fits the show, and it gives you like the overbearing sense of this world where this guy is going to be constantly... I don't know if you know what the show's about, but he's like...
I don't.
He has to... just be pitching you Ozark.
Yeah, please.
He has to...
sold.
Like, his partner's been laundering money for these I guess mafia guys. Uh-huh. I can't remember.
Uh-huh.
And they finally get caught, but he hasn't been doing it. But it's been through his firm. He knew about it, but he hasn't been doing it. Oh, he has been doing it. Sorry, he has been doing it.
Wow, you're really blowing this.
I know. The partner was taking money off of it, like skimming money off the top of it.
Oh, I see.
So they find out about that, and they're going to kill both of them. But Jason Bateman didn't know about it.
Oh, I see.
And so Jason Bateman, as a last-ditch thing, says, I'll make even more money than you were before. And they spare his life.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I guess you should see. I mean, I did spoil it kind of there.
Well, now I don't have to watch it because you don't know.
It's a good show.
Is it set in the Ozarks?
It's set in not Arkansas.
In Missouri?
In Missouri.
Oh, interesting. I used to go there as a child.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. It's probably going to be too triggering for me. that sounds really cool.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like a cool premise to be working with.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, that like gives you a real engine.
Mm-hmm.
I recently rewatched the Breaking Bad pilot, mm-hmm. and I was like, oh my god, so much happened in this pilot.
It's really well done.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know how they did it.
Because he gets cancer. He's got no respect at work or at home, really.
Yeah, he has that moment with the kid.
Yeah.
At the mall.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah.
And then
it's his birthday.
Yeah,
it's really, but it doesn't feel coincidental at all.
No.
They do such a great job of just, you know, lining everything up and letting them fire.
Speaking of like love taking over place over like 8 months or something, Breaking Bad was like 2 years.
Is that true?
Yeah, it was like because he turns 49 in the pilot. I think he turns like 50. I don't know. Maybe that's not quite true. Something like that.
Wow.
Oh, he turns 50 in the pilot, 51, or he turns 52 in the second.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the spinoff yet, but I heard it's so good.
Yeah,
I know. Good. I'm like 6 years late on the uptake or whatever, but. I feel like lately I've become a bento box consumer. Like I watch little bits at a time, and there's so much of it. I get so overwhelmed.
Right.
Like, I don't know what to watch.
Yeah. No, it's the problem today. There's too much stuff.
So much stuff.
Yeah. So anyway, what would you like to be doing next?
What would I like to be doing next? I hope to continue working on my own stuff. I think there's going to be a Barry season 3, which is really exciting. And I hope to finish a movie.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How's that been?
It's been really cool, actually, and really great. And I sort of got into screenwriting because, you know, as every young boy, loved movies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really cool that I have this space right now to be able to work on a couple films. So that's been really fun.
Yeah.
And I've been going back and rewatching a lot of thrillers, which has been awesome.
Yeah.
Which has been awesome.
What thrillers have you been rewatching?
I just rewatched Donnie Brasco, which I love.
I've never seen that one.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah.
I watched Silkwood.
Have you
seen Silkwood?
Yeah,
it's so good. It's out of print, I think. It's hard to find.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah. Oh. It was. I had to like buy a DVD off Amazon for like for like $50 or something. I was like, you can't find Silkwood
on crazy.
iTunes? I mean, guys, get it together. that movie is so incredible.
It is, yeah.
God, Cher in that movie is... Now I sound super gay. But Cher in Silkwood. Out of this world. Yeah, it's so good.
Mm-hmm.
And it really kind of leaves you hanging at the end.
Yeah.
It's really incredible. What else have I seen? I rewatched Silence of the Lambs. I guess The Godfather's not a thriller, but I mean, I rewatched The Godfather. I don't know. I'm just trying to go through all the greatest hits to be like, can I do this? Probably not, but let's hope for the best.
Okay, so we're going to wrap up. Will you give me your thoughts on a sketch idea?
Great. I'm horrible at notes. This is going to be great.
It's fine. So you know Dirty Jobs?
Yes.
The show with Mike Rowe?
Yeah. So fun fact, I used to have a huge crush on Mike Rowe.
Oh, really? He's kind of rugged.
I'm into it.
Yeah, he's kind of...
Wow, that's so embarrassing.
Well, if you don't know, if you're listening at home, it's a show where the guy does different, weird, and dirty jobs. So this would be a parody of that show, but he doesn't do jobs anymore. He just does like disgusting stuff. So he'd like go to a farm, and it's like seems like, oh, I'm gonna go milk this cow, but instead he just like rubs shit all over himself and just gets disgusting. So there's my sketch.
Would you play the guy?
Would I do it? I guess I could. I don't know. I hadn't thought that far.
Is shit smearing as dirty as it gets?
Well, that's a good question. I guess maybe if it is, that should come later. Or maybe it could get dirtier. I don't know.
Yeah, like, is that the starting point or is that the end point?
That probably needs to be an end point. Or maybe, I don't know. Probably. Shit smearing's pretty dirty.
Really? I think it's totally fine. What do you mean? I love it. Mm-hmm. I think you should go make it today.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, you should get Mike Rowe involved and then give him my number.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm married, but, you know. And he's straight, but who cares?
Yeah. Who knows?
Who knows?
All right. Anything, or thanks for coming out. Anything you want to plug?
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Anything I want to plug? Smart water.
Jennifer Aniston, if you're listening.
Jennifer Aniston, what she needs is more money.
Yeah.
Congratulations, Jen. You've done it.
All right, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
This has been a Boardwalk Audio podcast. For more information and shows, visit boardwalkaudio.com. Don't forget to rate and subscribe now.